that we're going to talk about a little later, but I'll put a lot of this on my site. Thank you so much, Valerie, Lauren, and Melanie, for coming on and giving us this, all this information, a lot of information. So if you're, so we'll plug you in. We'll plug you in. She's got the number.
Okay, so just
503-988.
Right. 4888. Yeah, I just wanted to double check that.
She got it. What is that one?
That's the Multnomah County Crisis Line.
Crisis Line.
And you can call for yourself. You could call for someone else as well if you're concerned about someone's mental health.
Meanwhile, poverty, housing crisis, so on. That was a good way to go out.
Yeah.
Well, see, boy, do we jam a lot in a half an hour.
That really did.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
On Progressive Spirits, I welcome back Bart Ehrman to talk about his new book, Jesus Before the Gospels, How the Earliest Christians Remembered, Changed, and Invented Their Stories of the Savior.
They remember Jesus as the one who wants people to be successful and rich, and you have other people who are saying that Jesus was a complete anti-materialist. Those kinds of different memories go all the way back in early Christianity.
Weekly podcasts on KBOO.fm/Progressive Spirit.
Compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. My name is Courtney Scott, and I am delighted to have Kit and John Collins, owners and operators of Out to Pasture Sanctuary, in the studio with us today. Welcome, Kit and John.
Thank you, Courtney.
Hi. Hello.
So, Kit and John, I've known you for a while, and I've always been so amazed at your dedication to your work with the animals. So tell us a little bit about your sanctuary. When did you start it, and why?
We started Out to Pasture in 2004, and we actually got started because I wandered into the feed store and there was a poster from Oregon Animal Rescue saying, "We need your help." So I just, on a whim, I called up and asked her what she did, and I found out this woman was driving a school bus for a living, had no land, and was finding animals that needed new homes, had been neglected or abused or abandoned, and she was moving them into new homes without having any land of her own or any money. She had a truck and a trailer, and that made me feel like, God, she's doing so much, and we have more than she has, and we're doing nothing. So we felt like doing something would be better than doing nothing. So that was the beginning of it. I took animals from Oregon Animal Rescue, and then we joined other animal rescue groups, and that was pretty much how we got started.
So that's been about 12 years then. You've been doing
yes.
it. So did you already have the property or in Estacada?
Yeah, we have a place with a few acres and a couple of barns, and we were already keeping some animals. We had, many people out live in the country or who have a barn or a building, they'll take in some animals. Friends have a cat that can't live in the house because it's incontinent, or a stray dog. So we were like that. We had taken in some animals, and we had a pony and a horse or two horses that we were feeding and taking care of. And so we were already had some of the facilities, and we were familiar a little bit with taking care of animals. Now it was just a matter of seeing how much more we could do when we realized there was so much need of animals that had nobody to take care of them.
Right. So in the meantime, you've taken in quite a few animals, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah. Quite a lot. We're pretty full now, and it keeps us busy.
You don't want
constantly.
Anybody to drop any off?
Like. No, please. We have to create a proper space and the proper procedures for each animal.
Right. So, John, you're a naturopath. Did that have anything to do with your empathy for animals? Is it connected to your practice in any way?
It is, actually, in a lot of ways. You know, naturopathy is primarily, we're trained to treat humans, diagnose and treat and prevent diseases in people. But animals, as you find, as you get to know them, they have so many qualities. And so their personalities, their pains, their sufferings, their needs are in many ways similar. I've had to learn some hard lessons that human diagnosis, human disease is not the same with animals. Sometimes animals' illnesses will appear quite different, or something that looks like a typical human illness is different in an animal. So I've had to work more closely with veterinarians and not try to rely on my knowledge of human medicine. But certainly it has impacted my practice a lot in that I was wondering if caring about animals would make it difficult for me to advise people regarding their diets, because most people are omnivores. Most people consume parts of animals or secretions of animals, such as milk, as part of their diet. And I didn't want to impose my personal values on people for my own sake. I have to serve my patients. But it turned out to be not that big of an issue as I learned more about it. It turns out that for the sake of people's health, it's much better to stay away from animal-based foods. And so there's really not a conflict there of helping to keep animals alive and take care of them and advising people on healthy nutrition. It turns out healthy nutrition for people involves not eating dead animals, because of all the different diseases that are, what do you say, enhanced or promoted by consumption of meat, even fish, dairy products, eggs, poultry. All these things taken in normal amounts contribute to many different diseases.
And in fact, you save quite a few animals that people would normally eat.
Yes, we have big hogs. We have a lot of chickens. We have turkeys,
sheep.
Rabbits, sheep, goats. Yeah, many of our animals were scheduled for slaughter, and someone convinced the owner to let them be rescued.
I bet they're pretty happy about that. Especially a slaughterhouse. I mean, I think most people know these days how bad slaughterhouses are, even if they haven't actually seen it. It kind of, you know, just the word kind of gives you that, you know, what it's really about.
Yeah.
So, Kit, what's your background? How did you get into this work?
Well, I grew up in pretty much the opposite of an animal sanctuary. My parents were raising animals to kill for meat, and we had quite a few different farm animals, and they were slaughtered, and we finally one day figured out we were eating our animal friends. We'd play with the goats one day, and they'd disappear, and we didn't realize that the meat on our plate was our goat friends. And then we really didn't want to eat meat, and our parents said we'd die if we didn't eat meat. And we were in the 4-H club, and we took animals to the auction. And so now, the rest of my life, I'd like to spend it helping animals instead of hurting them.
Wow, that's quite a jump from your background to where you are mm-hmm. now. So are your parents still alive, and are they still working in with farm animals?
Oh, no, they're both gone. I have 4 siblings. 3 of us are vegan, and 1's vegetarian. And the only one that's not is the one who was the youngest one, and she wasn't really around when we had the animals.
But so she didn't get an attachment to them?
No.
Wow, well, that's really interesting background. I have not the same background, but my father worked in a slaughterhouse for a meat packing company for his entire career. So we ate meat 3 times a day. So
yeah.
I'm sure you can relate to that.
Yeah.
Bring on the bacon. So what kind of animals do you guys rescue? You mentioned hogs and horses and chickens and not a cow. You don't have a cow.
No,
you have
cows.
Llamas.
Uh-huh, llamas, donkeys.
Donkeys.
A donkey.
Goats, sheep, a lot of chickens, a lot of roosters. At one point, we had over 50 roosters.
Wow.
Would you tell them that story, John? That the neighbor, we asked, do you mind if we get some roosters? She's like, oh, no, I love crowing. And then we kept getting more and more from backyards and from the feed store, and because at the feed store she was just going to, you know, give them away to be eaten. So we kept taking those. And pretty soon we had over 50 roosters. And then our neighbor decided he didn't like crowing that much. So we had to move them to the other side of the property, but We still have quite a few.
We're not taking in any more.
Yeah,
we
could. Yeah. Yeah.
Roosters are victims, or you could say are impacted so much by the raising of chickens for laying eggs. People want hens. They want a female. They want a female chicken, a hen, to lay eggs. And people, hobbyists, will have them for their backyard food production. But half of all chickens born are males, and so the males all have to be destroyed. They're often destroyed when they're hatched, if they can be identified, but many of them aren't properly identified, so people buy little chicks to be hens and find out that after, what is it, about 6-8 weeks, Olive starts crowing and has to be renamed Oliver, and then they have to get rid of it right away if it's in the city. So that's how we've gotten so many of our roosters, right. People who had these beloved little pets that they were raising by hand in their backyard, and then finally they get a cease and desist or whatever that notice you get from the sheriff that you've got to get rid of this crowing animal right away. So many of these were kind of desperate calls. But we urge people not to get involved in that in the first place, right. Of raising backyard chickens, because you're going to get roosters and you're going to have to do something with them. And there's no place for them to go. They have to be, they wind up, many of them, just getting slaughtered.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of what goes on at the zoo, because they breed elephants and, 50% are male. And those males are very hard to take care of. They can be aggressive, and they often have to use drugs on them and sell them to some other facility. Mm-hmm. So I think the male of the species is difficult sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, you got 50 roosters right now.
Well, we have less.
They don't live forever.
So we've been doing this. How long do they live?
8 to 12 years.
Yeah.
Oh, that's quite a long life.
So it's been a long time. Yeah. So some of them have passed away from old age. But we're keeping them going. Many of them have to be housed, have a home of their own. Many of them have their own house and their own little yard because
they don't get along with the others.
They don't get along. Right. A lot of them are real jerks. They have no manners, no compassion for their fellow rooster, and they just won't cooperate.
It's that rooster ego.
Yeah.
Rooster ego. Okay, so how many animals do you have right now?
We have about 150.
Wow. That is a lot of animals. So tell us about a typical day at the sanctuary then. What do you have to do to provide for them on a daily basis?
Well, we get up about 7:30, and then we have to mix medicines. We have animals that need special care. Then we're outside for about 2 hours feeding animals. Then we have to, on a typical day, commute to work, and we're gone. We leave about 10 in the morning. We get home about 8:30, sometimes 9 o'clock at night. Then we're back out there for another hour feeding animals. And we've got a few animals now, like I say, that have special needs that we're having to we have a big 800-pound hog that we're having to spoon feed. And we have a chicken with wry neck that can't lift her head up, so we have to either hold her up or brace her head up so she can eat, and we have to watch her eat. That takes a half an hour in the morning and a half an hour at night. So
yeah, so you have some special needs animals that really, takes a lot more time.
Yeah, whenever there's a special problem like that, it really affects the schedule. So we've been fortunate, though. We've never had more than two or three special needs animals at one time, and so we're able to fit it in.
Yeah, and then we stay home Wednesdays from work, but just Wednesday 2 days ago, I kind of jotted down what our day was. We got up and fed our animals, and we had to drive and pick up the sweet potato, their dog
food
chews.
Donation.
Yes, a food donation we could feed to the pigs. Then we had the hoof trimmer coming at 10. We had the vet at noon. We had to go to the feed store, and then John had to go to physical therapy because the 800-pound hog fell on him.
There are occupational hazards.
Then we had to come back and clean the stalls, feed the animals, and then we have a dog that was chained for 9 years that I have to, I take off walking. But, yeah, it's kind of a long day.
That's not your normal business day, is it? That could be painful, having an 800-pound hog. What did he land on your foot or?
She's a crippled pig, and she has she got up and tried to walk on two legs. Two of her legs are lame, and I was trying to brace her so she could walk a little bit, because it's good for her laying down too much. The muscles atrophy, If she wanted to exercise a little bit, I wanted to help her. So I was trying to help brace her, but she lost her footing. We were out in the mud, and she lost her footing and fell on top of me. Wow. And I could not get out. She was, I was under her pelvis, which is a really dense area, yeah. And so I couldn't move. And finally, she found that I wasn't that comfortable to lie on, and so she wiggled and wriggled to get comfortable, and I was able to pull myself up.
Lucky you.
Yeah, I was telling Kit to get her off.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, good luck with that, John.
Yeah. You need one of those cranes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this hog is pretty big. It's a farm hog, right?
Yeah.
So would hogs grow that big, or are they just are they genetically manipulated, do you think, to make them bigger like that?
I only know about that from reading, but what my understanding is that the wild type of hog is grows to be maybe 250, 350 pounds. And through selective breeding, they've gotten to be bigger and bigger. So we have friends who keep pet hogs that are 1,000, 1,200 pounds. So 800 is not unusual. But these animals normally get slaughtered before they reach their full size. They're still youngsters when they're slaughtered. About 30 million, 35 million a year in the United States every year, hogs are slaughtered at about, what?
Six months to nine months.
Right. Yeah.
But if you let them grow to their full lifespan, because of the way they've been bred, they get too big for their own joints is one of the common problems, and so they develop joint problems. They get wear and tear type of arthritis,
right,
or infections in their joints. And so we're in touch with a lot of different sanctuaries around the country that keep pigs through their full lifespan, and they say we've got a fairly young group of pigs, and they say, well, this is the way it's going to be. These pigs, as they get older, they have more and more joint mm-hmm. problems.
Right, that's just what our agricultural, industry has created. And the same with chickens, right? Chickens are like a little bit too heavy because of the way they're bred.
Yes,
and modified.
Some of them can't walk.
They're, right.
They put on too much meat and their legs can't hold them up.
Right. So we're going to take a short break right now. Stay tuned to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. So welcome back to Voices for the Animals with our special guests, Kit and John Collins of Out to Pasture Sanctuary. John, tell us some anecdotes about the animals. The fainting sheep, for example. I remember that when you gave a little talk a few years ago at the Alberta Library. Or any other interesting or humorous stories about the animals. I'm sure you have a bunch.
Yeah, fainting sheep is it's a known phenomenon, but we were, at the time, we were new to, at least I was, to raising sheep. And we had a dog on the property that got excited about the sheep being there and ran over and was barking at the sheep, stuck his head through a hole in the fence and was barking. And well, we went up, but the sheep was down. And so our thought was, oh, this was an older sheep that we had rescued. It wasn't a particularly sturdy animal. We figured it must have had a heart attack. It seemed to be dead. We thought maybe it had dropped dead from the shock or fear of being approached by a barking dog. So we were fussing over this animal, and it got up. And so that would really surprise us. We learned later that this is a phenomenon that's been observed. I don't know how frequent it is. We've only seen it happen once, and we've had quite a lot of sheep on the property. But sheep are known to faint when they get excited or startled.
It's kind of a pretty clever tactic, if you think about it, because
yeah.
the dog ignored them,
yeah,
the sheep,
that's
then,
true.
Right?
It's like playing possum, I guess.
Right, right. So what are some other stories?
The pony.
Tell them about the pony.
We came home one night after dark from work, and we're going out to do our evening chores, and which included feeding the elderly Shetland pony. And we had left her in the pasture, and she wasn't there. So we got flashlights and went looking around for her, and we walked all the fence lines and back and forth, zigzagged everywhere, and she was nowhere to be seen. So we were wondering if she had been stolen. We checked all the gates to see any signs of tampering. We couldn't find anything. But as we were at one end of the pasture, we heard a little sound that sounded like maybe that was the pony. So we went back, and there was a a thicket of blackberry bushes. Everybody around here knows what those are like. It was a very thick, overgrown area. The fence was up against it, and we heard that seemed like that's where the sound was coming from, but there was nobody there. And so we went on looking and looking, and we had to keep coming back to that was the only thing we knew. And so we finally examined the fence, and there was a little there was an overlap in the fence, and she had squeezed through the overlap and eaten her way into the thicket of blackberries. She was several feet inside this big blackberry thicket, completely invisible to us from the outside, and in a place where we thought it was impossible for her to be. So after that, with some effort and clippers and so on, we extracted her from the blackberries. But to us, it was the incident of the disappearing pony.
Yeah, it was like the Twilight Zone. We could hear her breathing, but we couldn't see her anywhere.
Wow.
And we believed that she could not possibly be there. So our minds were not processing the evidence we had. We just did not think it was possible for her to be on the outside of the intact fence. We didn't know that she had found a way out and that she was hiding behind the bush.
Wow. You're going to have to get like an animal detective.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know, for instance, some of the animals I've met there were Singer, who was a really interesting, beautiful horse who was kind of blind, wasn't she?
Yes. Yeah. She was pretty blind. And she had the seeing eye donkey, Sergio. She teamed up with him, and she would just follow him all over, and he would lead her out to pasture and lead her back in. And that was very nice to see.
Right.
Yeah, I remember the first time I noticed just how close they were. They were, when they were in a narrow containment area, they were next to each other because the food was there, I thought. But I remember the first time that spring I let them out into the open pasture, he ran out, and she was fumbling around trying to find her way through the gate. And then he came back and stood right in front of her and walked, let her approach him. She could smell and hear him. And then he walked forward a little bit more until she caught up with him. And I could see clearly he was voluntarily leading her out to where she wanted to go. So he was definitely her guide.
Yeah, that's really great. I bet you've witnessed quite a few like animals experiencing or exhibiting empathy.
Yeah, yeah, and it surprised me at first. I had thought the animals were pretty much self-centered and just, you know, dog eat dog or
llama eat llama.
Right. But yeah, we see cooperation like that. We see that they get used to each other and they start to depend on each other. And when you separate them, sometimes it's very upsetting.
Right. I was just going to say, wasn't there a horse that died and the other horse was kind of grieving for that horse?
Definitely, yes. That's one of the reasons we got one of our animals. It was a llama, I think, to keep company with that horse. How did we rearrange? There was these two that were together. It was Sergio and Boss Man. Boss Man died. Not Sergio, Rainbow.
Singer
and Boss Man. And when Boss Man died, Singer just stood and wouldn't eat and looked. She had a very droopy posture, and you could see that she was just in a very low energy state, which we might think of as depressed or grieving. And so it took a while. I think we brought another animal, a large animal, in with her finally, and she started to perk up.
Well, then we put Sergio with her finally.
Yeah.
That was a donkey.
Yeah. And then her eyesight went, and then they became really close.
Yeah, so Singer's dead now, right?
She's dead, and then Sergio grieved.
Oh,
so
really?
We had a neighbor that had a little miniature donkey, and he couldn't keep her anymore because of his own surgeries that he was having and disc problems. He couldn't handle the manual work of taking care of the large animal. And so right around that time that Sergio was grieving, we brought him a little miniature donkey, and now they're inseparable. So we see these kind of pairings quite a bit among the animals.
That's great. I love those stories.
Companionship.
Yeah. I think I remember, Wayne used to be with Lighthouse, and he told me he would always make sure to adopt out animals at two of a pair.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. So what challenges do you face rescuing and caring for so many animals? You mentioned the vet problems, learning how to deal with that, and what are some of the other issues, just having to take care of them all the time and always being responsible, never being able to go off to Tahiti, I guess, right?
We haven't been to Tahiti
yet. No, yeah. Oh, yeah, I guess we never go anywhere.
Sometimes we go to the dump and we think, hey, look at us, right. Look at us, we're traveling. We're getting out and about.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I guess the last 2 years we've been trying to make it up to Pig's Peace Sanctuary, and we can never do it. It's like... It's
so hard
to
leave. You
can't
even get to the pig sanctuary.
That's right.
What does that say?
Yeah, I think time is one of our biggest challenges. We just run out of time. And then, we've got a lot of animals, that have special needs. That's been a problem, yeah.
There's a temporary and reversible problem. We run into very often. We come home from work. It's a drive. It takes us 45 minutes or an hour because we have to stop on the way home. We pick up some vegetable donations at the Whole Foods grocery, or we stop and make a deposit at the bank or what have you. And so by the time we get home, we've been sitting in the car for an hour, and it's evening. It's 8 or 9 o'clock, and we think, we've been through this 1,000 times at least now over these years, where we look at each other, oh, gosh, now we have to go out and feed the animals. And it seems like every day you get that feeling again, like, oh, how am I going to do this? And again, once we're out there, we remark to each other, hey, it's nice out here. Hey, the animals are happy to see us. It's some things you so quickly forget, and yet you rediscover it again and again. Like with exercise, people don't want to exercise, but once they get out going, they realize they're enjoying it and it feels good. So it's kind of like that. So it's a momentary challenge, and then it seems to be always rewarded by feeling pretty good, being out, moving around in the fresh air, interacting with the animals. They're happy to see us because we're bringing them their food.
And then we don't want to go back in.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes you start puttering around outside. So it's actually enjoyable and challenging, kind of intermixed.
Mm-hmm. And I know I've been out there, and especially for your yearly party, what you call that?
Open house.
People love it there. I mean, they have such a good time, and they just love interacting with the animals. So I think it is like a whole other experience for people, especially people who live in the city here, like in Portland. And I think people, you didn't mention your work here is in Portland.
Right.
And that's why you have to travel so far to get to your farm. Right. So I know that fundraising is one of the biggest challenges that you face, right?
Yes, it's an ongoing activity because we keep spending money on veterinarians and feed and repairing. Animals keep breaking things, you know, so we have to keep repairing fences and this and that. So, yeah, the ongoing flow.
So what are some of the ways that you raise funds for the sanctuary, other than the open house is once a year in July?
Right, and that's just, we don't charge anything. We sell some merchandise. We have some, T-shirts and this and that. But at the open house, a lot of people come, and there's always a number of people that give us donations at that time. Our first and ongoing yearly fundraiser has been our yard sale. We have a big yard sale. My office in Portland is in the Hollywood District. It's in a good location for something like a yard sale.
Yeah, it's right near Hollywood Fred Meyer.
Right across the street from Hollywood Fred Meyer. And so we put on a big yard sale at the beginning of summer, usually end of June or early July every year. We wait till we get a break in the weather, so we just kind of announce it last minute, because that's the time of year when it's often raining and you're waiting for the sun to come out. And so as soon as we get, we can see that we're going to have a few days of sun in a row, then we put everything out and have that big yard sale. And that's actually a pretty good part of budget for one thing. And then we started an... There's a number of different things. Some individuals will come up to us and say, we want to do a fundraiser for you. We had somebody a few years ago said they wanted to put on a dinner. They were going to cook dinner for a bunch of their friends, ask everybody to donate what they could, and they would give all the money to the sanctuary. So we didn't do anything. They did all the work. Other fundraisers, we put it on and organize it. There was one we did last year, which was fun, in conjunction with a vegan restaurant, Portobello. And
how did that go?
That was
sold out.
Yeah,
that's
it sold
great.
Out. Yeah.
Excellent.
They're normally closed on Monday, and they said a couple times a year they'll put on a fundraiser on a Monday, and they will ask the beneficiary to pay for their food supplies, but they will donate their labor, and any profit will be donated.
Great.
And they asked us to provide the table service staff, so we got a bunch of volunteers. And waited on tables, and it was a lot of fun.
That sounds great. So are there any events coming up that you want our audience to know about?
Well, most of our events are May through October. The next thing would be the yard sale.
Okay, that's, so that's in the summer.
Yeah, that
okay.
might be the end of May if it's sunny. And then
we'll announce that on Facebook.
Yeah, pretty much you have to, you know, the website and the Facebook will announce events.
Okay, so people, if they want to get involved, should go to your website and your Facebook.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, and it's Out to Pasture Sanctuary.
Yes,
okay.
That's updated quite frequently.
Okay, so that's great. So actually right now I'm going to end the program. If you have anything else you want to add?
Nope, I don't.
I hear silence.
Yeah,
okay.
Well, thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, oh, you're so welcome. Thank you, Kit and John, for joining us today. And thanks to our audience for tuning in to Voices for the Animals. Catch our next program on Monday, April 25th. You can listen online to the podcast of this program on KBOO FM.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Monday, March 28, 2016. In local news, on Friday, a federal court found an Oregon law protecting salmon streams from gold mining operations to be legal. The law, passed in the 2013 state legislature, went into effect this year and limits suction dredging and other motorized mining operations in Oregon's prime trout and salmon streams. After the law was passed, gold mining operators unsuccessfully sued the state of Oregon in federal court in an attempt to have the law overturned. The law, Senate Bill 838, allows the state of Oregon to regulate land usage on both state and federal lands in order to protect water quality and wildlife habitat. Suction dredging and other motorized mining operations in streams has been found to release large plumes of mercury into the streams, leading to high toxicity levels in fish. The mining operations also destroy water clarity, leading to protests from other